Hey, I'm Sam.
And I'm Lizzie.
And we're queer people who love movies.
This is Subtextual.
Hi, I'm Sam. Like I'd marry you, you'd be the meanest wife ever.
Hi, I'm Lizzie. And wait, can you hold on just a moment? I'm on my hamburger phone.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. Oh, and this is Subtextual.
This is the hamburger phone hotline. Hi, welcome to Subtextual.
What do we do here, Lizzie?
We take films, look at them with a queer lens, and find all the fun gay stuff inside. And today I'm assuming our gender and media studies coursework is going to be put to good effect for Juno.
Yeah, time to whip out your minors, folks. And we're going to dive deep into Juno. I'm glad you mentioned the burger phone. I didn't know if I would get into it, if we'd have time. But a quick bit of trivia is that is the hamburger phone that belonged to Diablo Cody herself.
She brought it to set.
Yeah, it was her burger phone.
It felt so important and specific. I'm so in love with that.
So this is such a hefty episode. I love this movie to no end. So I'm going to try to do my best to like jam pack it with as much info as I can. But before we jump into the movie, I do want to give a huge thank you to our patrons, the folks supporting us over on patreon.com. And if you're one of our highest level patrons, you actually chose this movie for us to talk about today. That's something you can do by being a patron of ours. So Juno, great choice.
Yes, 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 yes.
I really wanted to talk about Elliot Page this month, so I'm really glad that you guys selected Juno, and what an incredible film. I'm very excited to get into it today. Lizzie, do you remember the first time you saw Juno?
It's hard to say the first time I saw Juno, because no doubt I've seen Juno dozens of times over the years. I had the soundtrack.
Yeah, you did.
On my iPod. But it had been probably a good 8 years since I'd last seen this film. So I was interested to go back with like the lens that we've cultivated here on Subtextual and watch it again. And I was a little nervous it wouldn't be just like structurally as good as I had once remembered it. But I was so unbelievably wrong. Like technically this film, I think, is really, really, dare I say, perfect. Like the editing is so good. The writing is so good. The directing, the acting. Like I really have very little qualms with this film. So I was really relieved that it lived up to all the love that I had for it. And then some, because there were certain things that I had missed somehow in all those dozens of watches. But this is kind of a beloved movie for me, come to find out.
Yeah, watching it as a teenager and watching it now as a full-grown adult elicits totally different responses from me.
Definitely.
What about you, Lee? Do you remember the first time you watched this film?
I can't remember the first time, but definitely the last time I saw it was kind of around the time that it came out. So it's been a long time since I've seen it, but I remember the sort of hype around it and how everyone was talking about how the way people talk in this movie, the Diablo Cody writing, you know, there's definitely a lot of conversation about that. I loved it. I remember really liking it, but it's been a long time, so I kind of want to revisit.
I hope you do. I hope this episode incites you to do so. I love Juno. I've always had a soft spot in my heart for this film. I remember lying to my mom and saying I was watching some other bullshit movie and then sneaking in to see this film. And I remember being with my mom in a Target and buying the soundtrack and her being very like, well, you know, you're not allowed to see that movie because it had to do with like a pregnant teenager. And I was like, yeah, I think I like the people on the soundtrack. I'm not going to watch the movie. And she let me buy it with like my own money. And I had totally been obsessed with the movie. I'd seen it like 4 times in theaters at that point.
It's so funny that you bring up that your mom had a hard time letting you watch that film, because I had that same exact experience. And I thought it was just because I was raised in like a really Christian household. But it's interesting that you say that too, because like just, and I don't think if any parent had watched this film, I think they would have had a different opinion about it, because, I mean, we'll talk about it, but like the Juno character isn't flagrant with her sexuality or anything like that, or negligent with, she understands completely and takes full responsibility for her actions, which is like almost to the point that this could have been like training for young people to be like, well, if you have sex, this could happen.
Yeah.
You know, but my mom, I had to hide from her that I saw this film.
No, yeah, my parents definitely had a judgment call on the film before they had seen it. I don't know if they've ever actually seen it ever. But as you're saying, I think as soon as you finish the film, you realize it's not like a romanticization of teenage pregnancy, which, you know, there was a lot of turmoil and we were in a very interesting political place, which I'll get into when we talk about the reception of this film. But this wasn't like a lovely place for this film to land in the time that it was released. And I think regardless of that, it still was able to hit a lot of people in the right places, like us as teenagers and maybe folks a little bit older. And then, you know, it got a lot of critical acclaim, which I don't want to do spoilers for the reception, but I don't think anyone here is under the impression that it wasn't a good movie. But the reason we're talking about this film today is, I don't know, it's interesting. It's more nuanced than I think when I typed in Juno Gay. that search was definitely flooded with a lot of information about Elliot Page. I'm a big, huge fan of Elliot Page. Before they transitioned, before they came out as queer, I really followed their career pretty closely. I think I have every DVD of everything they've ever been in. I am still and have been a huge fan. I think aside from Elliot Page's transness, though, this film has always signaled really queer to me. I think the character of Juno has struck a chord in a lot of queer people, not even just women, but queer people across the board, as someone who doesn't put a huge stake in presenting in a way that is convenient for a lot of people. I think that feels like a really gay rallying call. There's so many subtextual reasons that I really fuck with this movie. But I mean, Lizzie, when you watch this movie, do you remember why it made you feel kind of like queer, subtextual?
Absolutely. And for me, it really does center around the Juno character. And like you said, presentation and choice and how Juno shows herself to the people around her, but also how she kind of like stands apart from the people around her. Like we see her with her family, with this new family, with her friends. And even though she gets along with everyone, like she's not in conflict with almost anyone in the film at any point, you know, in like an aggressive sense, she stands apart from them, but she doesn't seem to be lonely or isolated because of it. Well, I say that, but there was like a loneliness to this film that I picked up that I don't think I had really gotten in other watches. But just like the singularity of expression that this character has, and also how unique this character is styled and their room and their items and the things that they're interested in, like kind of defied gender norms, but even in that, like defied what defiance of gender norms looked like, you know, because I was a tomboy, you know, because I hated girly shit for a myriad of reasons tied to my sexuality. But Juno wasn't like being like contra-flow to society because she wanted to be a rebel. She was just being herself, and it entered this like kind of other space that she created for herself. And I found her to be very empowering. And like you can never just boil down this movie to like girl has premature sex, gets pregnant, and like deals with the consequences. Like it's a lot more about how this particular person handles like a year in their life.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have tried to point to this film to say that it's making one insular specific point, and it really isn't. It's touching on a lot of different themes, you know, and why I appreciate all the films Elliot Page had picked in their career up until this point was because I trusted that actor Elliot Page to pick roles that I felt really gave a license and an agency to the characters. And I think Juno was just another facet of that. And I remember being, you know, closeted watching this film in 2007 when it was released, and not even being in a place to like hope the character was gay, but there was a part of me that was like, if this character is straight, I'm also really happy with that, because if people can accept women presenting in this way that is not super feminine,
yeah,
in any regard, it's a help to me.
Yeah, I think that was what was really powerful about the Juno character for me, and for someone so young.
Yeah,
I mean, this character was 16 and was intelligent and totally singular and had interesting taste without being pretentious. Like that was, and also had full control of their sex life. Like for me, that was something unheard of, because at 16, I didn't feel like I had control.
And that is just the like antenna that goes up when you watch this the first time. Yeah. People, I mean, going back and doing the research for this film, I learned so much about more subtext that can be found So to get that kicked off, we can start with the production.
Yes.
Directed by Jason Reitman. He is a Canadian director known before this for Thank You for Smoking. And then, you know, after this in 2009, he directed Up in the Air, which got some like Oscar buzz. What I love about Jason Reitman is that he has directed a total of 3 films with scripts written by Diablo Cody.
No, really? What films?
This is his first film. His second film would be Young Adult in 2011 with Charlize Theron. And then his third film, based on the script of Diablo Cody, would be Tully, also starring Charlize Theron.
I really want to do that film at some point. I remember that film being really gay and like a lovely subtextual way. Diablo Cody, though.
I know. If you have not heard us wax poetic about Diablo Cody, please just listen to the Jennifer's Body episode. But if you don't want to, I am going to touch on all the important facets of her in relation to this film. So don't worry. You don't have to go and pause this and listen to that. I'll fill you in pretty quickly. A little bit more about Jason Reitman, the director. His father is Ivan Reitman, who is known for directing the original Ghostbusters 1 and 2. Nepo Baby, we love to see it.
But like with talent, though, because you got to say,
yeah,
all the films he's done are really, really good.
Another thing I do want to mention, though, he was offered the opportunity to direct Dude, Where's My Car? And declined.
Well, so he's an idiot.
But he was offered a talented twice idiot. And said no.
Twice? Yes. Would that have been his debut feature? Because if so, I'm like, okay, maybe.
It would have been. Which I would have said yes both times.
Yes and 1,000 times yes.
Yes and yes. But like we mentioned, this was written by Diablo Cody.
Love.
I think subtextual is like in big text and underneath, it's like founded by Kenny Ortega and Diablo Cody, right? Yeah.
This is a Julia Stiles, Diablo Cody, Kenny Ortega stan account.
It's got to involve one of those. We're fucking out of here. Diablo Cody obviously wrote this film. This was a huge breakout for her. She was encouraged to start writing by a friend of hers, film producer Mason Novak. He encouraged her to start writing after her blog became very popular, called The Pussy Ranch. She turned that into her memoir, Candy Girl, A Year in the Life of an Unlikely Stripper. I know that's one of Lizzie's favorite books, right?
It's one of my favorite memoirs. I brought it up during the Hustlers episode that I thought it was so informative and hilarious. And A Year in the Life of a Stripper post-2008 financial crash. But she is so funny. I want to know how her writing process just allows her to put so many direct and specific references into a work that just make it so fucking catchy.
No, she's such a like talent for encapsulating very like niche subcultures and like human dialogue, especially for teenagers, of course, which she wasn't when she wrote this script. But like I said, she was encouraged to write and then write that memoir. But then she was further encouraged by that same producer to write the screenplay adaptation of that memoir. She never did end up writing that memoir screenplay, but in practice and in exercise, she actually ended up writing Juno.
Oh my God.
Which was her first screenplay. And she said that she took inspiration from a close friend of hers who had become pregnant in high school. And she wrapped that in with her own high school experiences. A lot of the things like the burger phone, the Tic Tacs, the best friend, cheerleader, all of those things were very close to her personal life. And she said on the script's completion, that she was really cynical about the process and didn't believe that the film would ever get made.
Damn.
The film from that producer that encouraged her to write was passed on to Jason Reitman. And he said reading it halfway through, he knew he had to direct it.
I just got chills.
He was like, if I don't direct this, then I'm like, it would be a huge failure if I didn't.
Yeah.
But Cody was right to a degree to be as cynical as she was. It, you know, due to the subject matter, the film did face financial trouble and dealt with delays until being eventually picked up by John Malkovich's production company.
He's done so much.
Yes, thank you, John Malkovich. Again, another staple here in the subtextual filmography.
Yeah, we all want to be John Malkovich.
I remember doing a spit take watching this and doing the research that, like, in the title credits, it was like, produced by John Malkovich. I was like, what the fuck is he doing here?
What the fuck is he doing here? He's welcome.
Love that. I love that he saw this and was like, that's the one for me. So another reason that this film feels really gay and subtextual, and when I type in Juno gay, all these articles come to the forefront, would obviously be Elliot Page, an incredible Canadian actor. Before Juno, they were rising to prominence with films like Hard Candy.
Yes, love Hard Candy.
Incredible job in Hard Candy. And then X-Men, The Last Stand. I know we've talked about doing all of the X-Men movies here because they're super gay.
Oh, yeah. X-Men is just code for gay.
Yeah. If it's an X-Men movie, it's gay. After Juno in 2007, he would star in Whip It and then Inception. Yes. And then X-Men Days of Future Past. Incredible, incredible talent. And in 2014, Elliot Page, who at the time presented female, came out as gay during a speech at the Human Rights Campaign mm-hmm. Time to Thrive conference. I remember where I was when they gave that speech. It was, that whole day was lovely to see the speech, very courageous of them to have come out. And I remember a feeling, sometimes when you see other people come out, it kind of just sucks you back to where you were when you did, you know? And that was one of those days where I my heart really went out to Elliot Page. It's not easy to do, especially not easy to do twice, which they would have to do.
Yeah.
In the rest of their career. So, I mean, do you remember Page coming out as, I guess at that time would have technically been a lesbian as they presented female?
I remember being not surprised. Mm-hmm. I almost remember being like, oh, and kind of like assuming they were gay, I think because of Juno. That was my earliest experience watching Elliot Page's work, and I always kind of knew, like, this isn't a straight character. Even before I knew I wasn't a straight character, I knew there was something about Juno that was different. So
you're like, this character reminds me of me, and I know I'm fucking gay.
Yeah, right. So I remember being not surprised, but I'm also watching this film back, kind of like when we were talking about Bound and the Wachowski sisters. I'm like, does playing a character that is so different from the norm and is like constantly being told, wow, you're different. Wow, you don't fit into gender roles. Wow, wow, wow. Like, was that like poking at anything in a young Elliot Page's process? Like, we'll never know. I'll never know if making Bound like affected the Wachowski sisters in any way to them like later coming out. But I just think it's interesting that Elliot Page always gravitated to these roles that like were centered around a female presenting character that was just different somehow and unique in that difference. And I think Elliot Page is awesome. All the works you just listed, I'm like, yep, we love.
No, you make a really good point. And I think Elliot Page and I can talk a little bit more about, you know, how they relate to their work now because they've given a really incredible interview with Time Magazine. But since coming out as queer while presenting female in 2020, they came out again as a trans man on social media and revealed their new name, which is Elliot Page, which I think rolls off the tongue very well. I love that name. They expressed that their decision to come out publicly was prompted partially by the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as like the anti-transgender rhetoric that was very much like in the news cycle. And it's still at this point very much Republican talking point. So I can't imagine how hard that would be, especially as someone in a public eye to feel the need to I hope they don't feel like they had to. But unfortunately, sometimes that is the case. People feel like they are pushed out of the closet. But regardless of why they did come out, I think I know so many people in my personal life and I know how it affected me. Very, very meaningful. And I just like salute them for it. It couldn't have been an easy thing to do.
Mad respect, because actors and actresses, their fame is like owned by society. And we've talked a bunch of times about how certain levels of fame almost seem like abusive and how little control someone has over their own story. So I really, really respect that Elliot Page rewrote their own story and was very public about it, because with the Wachowski sisters, again, also being like public figures in film, they were very close to the chest with their experience, which I totally respect and understand. And Elliot Page coming publicly to the forefront with their own words and their own understanding of it all was just like, still to this day, I'm like, fuck yeah.
Yeah.
Like a fucking public figure. You just like sealed yourself into history in a way.
Huge snaps to Elliot Page.
Yes.
From the start of their career to presently, a huge outspoken advocate for a myriad of things: human rights, women's rights, abortion rights, queer rights, animal rights. So keep doing what you're doing. You're fucking kicking absolute ass.
Yeah. And also just an amazing fucking actor. Truly. Show me one moment in Juno that doesn't center around Elliot Page that isn't perfect.
Elliot Page does an incredible job acting in this film. And I do, as you mentioned that, I do want to reference that, like, if I'm talking about the character of Juno, I will be using she, her pronouns. If I'm talking about Elliot Page, I will be using he, they pronouns, as that is how they identify. So Elliot Page didn't stop there. They're responsible for why this fucking soundtrack is as great as it is.
Wait, they perform on the soundtrack?
They don't perform on the soundtrack, but Elliot was the person that tuned Reitman in to Kimya Dawson in The Moldy Peaches.
Oh my God.
Which I think this soundtrack is one of my favorites of all time. Me and Lizzie, I've put it in my top four before for this very reason. Like, as far as indie music goes, I mean, this opened up a floodgate for me as a young person, but... Jason Reitman recounts on the soundtrack of this film saying, he, meaning Elliot Page, went on my computer, played the songs, and I fell in love with it. I got in touch with Kimya Dawson of the Moldy Peaches, and she started sending me her work, which was beautiful, and became a lot of the soundtrack. And Kimya Dawson actually sent him a packet of CDs containing over 120 songs.
Oh my God. Hey, what is it? Luck is when chance meets opportunity.
Absolutely.
Kimya's like, boy, do I have 12 inches of CDs for you.
Kimya's like, love the script. Have every song I've ever written, maybe.
I mean, I don't know if Juno would be the same without the Moldy Peaches and Kimya Dawson soundtrack. Like, they are as important as the script to me.
No, and this, I was a teeny fucking bopper, as my mom would like to say, when I
teeny bopper
bought this soundtrack, but it has made absolute waves in my, like, entire personality as a young adult. So I can't thank Elliot Page enough, Jason Reitman enough, or Kimya Dawson enough for all putting their entire cabussies, Kimya Dawson essies.
Another question that was like tickling at the back of my mind, how old was Elliot Page during the filming of Juno?
That's a great question. So the character of Juno is supposed to be 16, but Elliot Page was actually 20.
Oh, okay. So still a very young person.
Not too far off. Yeah.
Still basically a teenager. Well, it's cool that the filmmakers were so open to just like suggestions from the cast and crew, which is how I feel like it should be. I don't know if indie film is quite like that anymore. I feel like this film was like the golden age, or like maybe the dawn of this golden age of like actual independent films that went to Sundance and did really well, you know, like Little Miss Sunshine. Mm-hmm. I feel like these are like the same type of movie that just had like a heyday in these like mid-2000s.
You could also posturize that, like, because the budget is so low and they don't have music supervisors or X, Y, and Z, that they really have to rely on the actors for characterization and points going forward. I know if I was a director, I had a really low budget and I'm managing 700 different things, and a character in the cast was like, I think my character should wear a striped t-shirt. I'm like, fine, wear a fucking striped t-shirt. Like,
yeah.
There's shit going on.
I know Diablo Cody, for example, like gave a lot of her own t-shirts to Jennifer's Body. Mm-hmm. So, and then she donated her hamburger phone to this production. So I would say almost limitations for independent films can sometimes make them better, because you're not just like, okay, what can money buy, and allowing the people who give you the money to make all the decisions. It's like, okay, we literally have no money. What do we have in our arsenal? And I just think that better art can come from that, because you're more intentional.
Yeah. I mean, same could be said with Scott Pilgrim. All of them are wearing band shirts that are like from a personal collection of both Edgar Wright and the writer of Scott Pilgrim. So it's like, well, we have period specific shirts from that era because there are fucking shirts. Wear the fucking shirts.
We wrote them into the script because we have them. Here they are.
Yeah. So let's get into the movie.
Okay.
I'm pregnant.
Who is the father?
It's Polly Bleeker.
Polly Bleeker? I didn't think you had it in.
I know, right?
I could, like, have this baby and give it to someone that, like, totally needs it.
You should look in the Penny Saver.
They have ads for parents.
Yeah. Desperately seeking spawn.
Hi. I'm Vanessa.
Hi. I'm the husband.
This, of course, is Juno.
Like the city in Alaska.
No.
We start off in autumn in Elk River, Minnesota.
I thought it could be Minnesota.
Minnesota. Everything about this film feels Canadian because it's all shot in Canada with Canadian actors.
Why couldn't we just say it's in Canada?
It felt very important that they stick to the USA bit. And I'm like, it could have been Canada, but for sure.
Because isn't Michael Cera also Canadian?
Elliot Page is from Canada. Uh-huh. Michael Cera is from Canada. Jason Reitman's from Canada, and they use like everybody from Degrassi in this movie. So it's all very Canadian.
Sure, we're in Minnesota.
And we see Juno on her way to take a pregnancy test, and this like intro is all stop motion collage.
So good. I love the credits. So good.
The songs in this fucking movie have no business slapping as hard as this. Like, that artist is actually like a children's music artist.
It's very like Cat Stevens.
Yeah.
Modern Cat Stevens.
Yeah. Love it. And so Juno walks into a drugstore after chugging a handle of Sunny D to take another pregnancy test. Is it rude to call something a handle of Sunny D?
No, that's accurate. Oh my God. I've also been here. The pregnancy test care. Of course I. Every human that has sex with men has been here.
Okay, I was about to say, hey.
That has sex with men.
Okay. Well, did you chug a bunch of Sunny D before?
You can always piss when you need to, is what I've learned over the years.
And it's confirmed. She takes another pregnancy test and she is pregnant.
Yep.
Your ego is prego. No doubt about it.
What's the prognosis, Fertile Myrtle?
It's so hard to not touch on every scene because of the fucking amazing dialogue here.
That's a Diablo Cody thing, for sure.
You learn so much about Juno in this first scene. She's fucking annoyed to be pregnant. It's not even like a big crisis. It's like, oh, fuck, I'm fucking pregnant. Shit.
Yeah, I love that the drama of this isn't like, oh, how do I tell people I'm pregnant? It's like how complicated her entire life is after outside of this.
After she takes the fourth pregnancy test and it's confirmed she's pregnant, we get her going back to her house to her gay-ass bedroom.
This fucking bedroom.
And Lizzie, what have we said about teenage girls' bedrooms on this fucking podcast?
There's always shit on the walls. They're always throwing parts of their identity out onto the walls to see what sticks. And usually what sticks is the gay shit.
Some gay fucking shit. Sometimes characters are so straight that if anything, the posters on their wall confirm the fact that they're absolutely heterosexual. And we'll see that juxtaposed in this scene. Like, Juno's walls are like grunge, goth art,
yeah.
Band posters, Bikini Kill, Patti Smith.
There's no, like, muscled man in sight.
There is no man in this room at all. And on the side of, like, in the corner of her room, you see a Harmony Bobcat.
What is that? An instrument?
Not only is it an instrument, Elizabeth, it is the guitar that I have in my collection. It's my favorite guitar. It might be single-handedly the gayest guitar that's ever existed. Not to jump too much into a Harmony Bobcat, but if you are looking for an entry-level lesbian-ass guitar, you can go ahead and give it a goog. It's a beautiful electric guitar, solid body, and it has a lower neck ratio. So sometimes when you like jam on like a Les Paul or something, it's full length, and the Harmony Bobcat is 3/4 length, so it's like easier for your hand to spread across.
Oh my God.
And it has some incredible DeArmond pickups that people literally buy the guitar for $600 because the pickups are worth more than the guitar itself. But me, I'm an OG collector. I have the guitar with the pickups. I would never pull them off. Anyways, some other noteworthy people to play a Harmony Bobcat would be Saint Vincent, the biggest lesbian
in present day
rock and roll. She's the reason I have a Harmony Bobcat. I didn't even realize Juno played a Harmony Bobcat until I watched this movie recently. So shout out to Harmony Bobcat owners. I hope you like your Bobcat. I hope you like your Subaru and everything else is working out for you.
Let's take a break to throw over an advertisement to our sponsor, Harmony Bobcat.
Do you have $400? Are you a lesbian?
Boy, do we have the guitar for you. Also, at some point, Juno says her favorite bands are The Stooges, Patti Smith, and The Runaways. Why is every gay character in these movies like, well, I love The Runaways. Like, is that just like the biggest indicator ever? Because we just saw this in 10 Things I Hate About You.
Yes.
Fucking Kat Stratford.
The parallels between this movie and that movie, because both of the characters are so, in an earnest way, they do fall in love with a man that doesn't feel really like heteronormative.
Yeah. And their control of that relationship, which I think kind of speaks to someone who's not, you know, centralizing men in their life, but choose to be with one.
And the fucking most lesbian man they can find.
Exactly.
Michael Cera, Heath Ledger.
Michael Cera cannot grow facial hair.
If he tried. No, these are like bona fide lesbians in a literal sense.
It's like Training Wheel lesbians.
Exactly. Like, we all need to get to Sarah Lawrence some way, somehow, baby.
Someone's got to hold her hand while we're getting there.
And in Juno's room, she calls her best friend Leah on the hamburger phone. Ugh. Leah is played by Olivia Thirlby, one of my first ever major crushes.
Yeah, I can see that for you.
I was obsessed with her. I watched her. She was in actually Lena Dunham's first ever directorial debut.
Tiny Furniture.
Wow. And it was with her and Jim Halpert. Who's that guy?
Oh, John Krasinski.
I basically watched everything she ever did on 1, 2, 3 movies. I love Olivia Thirlby. And a quick fun fact, as per Elliot Page's recent memoir, they were dating at this time.
Shut up.
Yep.
During this movie?
Yeah.
Shut up.
Yep.
That's so cute.
Doesn't it make all the scenes seem so much gayer?
So much gayer.
They have incredible chemistry.
They do. Mm-hmm. I also love talking about rooms. You get to peek into Leah's room as well in
straightest
this montage.
Room ever.
Yeah, it's like muscly torsos, pink, white lace, like kicking her feet on the bed. Whereas like Juno does that, like she's always like slouching in like this really like kind of gay way, like against walls or on beanbags or in chairs. Like straight girls don't sit like that.
No, her body language reads so queer, and like the cadence of her voice reads so fucking queer as well. And she tells Leah that she's pregnant, and Leah says, "It's probably just a food baby. Did you have a big lunch?" But nowhere in this conversation is it a possibility that Juno keeps this baby. It's all very much like, well, are you going to Woman Now or the other health clinic?
I'm going to go to Woman Now because they help out women now.
They like help out women now. Do you want me to make the call for you? Because I made the call for like Stephanie or something.
I love how they're fully informed about their abortion options at such a young age.
Yeah, so quick. And then after this conversation, we get introduced to Polly.
Polly Bleeker. This is the perfect song for him.
I know. Polly Bleeker and his skinny ass.
His little skinny ass legs.
Polly is played by Michael Cera. Obviously, a huge breakout role for him.
Breakout? Really?
Yeah. Well, he had been like...
Arrested Development.
Yeah, he had done a lot of TV in Canada and then Arrested Development, which was like not a huge hit in the U.S. I think it was more of like a sleeper hit. But yeah, this was like his first kind of more adult role.
Sweet.
He steps outside with his Hot Pocket to a full like living room assortment on his front lawn where Juno is like smoking a pipe. And she tells him that she's pregnant. And she's like, yeah, sorry I had sex with you. Anyways, I'm going to get rid of this fucking baby.
Okay, so this came out the same year as Superbad, didn't it?
Wait, when did Superbad come out?
2007, I'm pretty sure.
This would be the same year.
What a year for Michael Cera. He basically plays the same character, and I love that for him. And we've covered both of his movies of his debut year now.
He didn't know what he was getting into. He was going to be covered to hell and back on Subtextual.
I've always talked about Michael Cera as like an actor I've, for some reason, like felt I shouldn't like, but always did. And finally, I just gave myself into it. I'm like, Michael Cera is just a cutie little sweetie pie.
Yeah, unfortunately, he's as endearing as everyone thinks he is.
I know.
He's so sweet.
And he's a great musician, too. I know, and, like, he plays guitar in this role. He had to, like, dumb down his bass skills for Scott Pilgrim.
Okay, so Juno heads to Women Now because they, like, help out women now.
They help women now.
And she goes to get an abortion, and on her way in, she runs into her classmate, Soo-Chin, who tells her that babies have fingernails.
I honestly didn't know that. And I didn't need to know it.
And she just like runs out of there super fucking overwhelmed.
God appreciates your miracle.
And something Allison Janney's character, like she says later, is like, someone's going to find a precious gift from Jesus in this goddamn dumpster fire of a situation.
They have fingernails, really.
But she finds Leah, her best friend, and says she can't abort this baby and she wants to give it to a family that cannot have their own. So I'm going to show you that scene now.
I don't want to give the baby to a family that describes themselves as wholesome.
Why?
Well, I don't know. I just want something a little more edgier.
Okay, what did you have in mind exactly?
I was thinking more like graphic designer, mid-30s, you know, with a cool Asian girlfriend who like dresses awesome and rocks out on the bass guitar. But I don't want to be too particular.
Okay. How about this? Educated, successful couple seeking infant to join our family of five. You will be compensated. Help us complete the circle of love.
Yeesh. That sounds great.
They sound like a friggin' cult, is what they sound like. And besides, they already have three kids, you know? They're just like greedy little bitches.
Oh, Juno, how about this one?
They were Mark and Vanessa Loring, and they were beautiful even in black and white.
So now that Juno has picked the perfect family to adopt her child, she goes to tell her parents.
I love this scene.
Her dad is played by J.K. Simmons.
Yes.
And her mom, excuse me, and her stepmom, Bren, is played by Allison Janney. Two Allison Janney bangers in a row.
Let's go. Can we make it a third? I love Allison Janney's Bren character. She like cuts out pictures of dogs. She wears pink turtlenecks. She crafts.
She's a nail tech.
She's a nail technician. And she's fierce.
Yes.
And that's what another thing I love about this film is that, like, for the most part, the men in her life, in Juno's life, do like the bare minimum to like be there for her. Like, they're never cruel or neglectful necessarily, but it's really the women in her life. Her girlfriend slash best friend, Leah, Bren, and even Vanessa that really show up for her.
Yeah, the other men aren't like pulling away in responsibility. They're not trying to do like the least amount acceptable, but they're doing the like societal acceptable roles.
Mm-hmm.
And you just see how night and day it is, especially like Bren, her stepmom, who it doesn't even seem like she really particularly cares for in any way.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, well, I'm getting you the vitamins. I'm sewing the waistband into your jeans.
Yeah.
I'm taking you to your appointments.
Stands up for her when that whatever tech like kind of talks down to her. Mm-hmm. That's the thing is like, I think the men, they say the right things, but the women are actually doing shit for her. Like Leah's like, can I call the abortion clinic? I was going to come pick you up. Like, it's there for her whenever she's actually having the baby. And I think that, I just really like that.
Yeah, it's just really lovely and really supportive. And so she tells her parents that she's pregnant. It would be freaking sweet if no one hit me.
Wait, doesn't this feel like a coming out scene, though?
It really, truly does. And you have, like, Leah back behind,
right.
You know, just kind of just being generally supportive, and they all,
I'm sure they were wondering in the back of their heads at some point, like, is she a Katie Lang fan?
No, she has a picture of Jared Leto in her desk. It's fine. But yeah, surprisingly, they're a little more supportive than I think she anticipated them being. And I think it's helpful that she's like, I already found a family. I know I don't want to be a mother. These people are going to, like, do right by this kid. Like, I'm just not going into this with the, like, insane perception that I am in a place to, like, parent a child.
Not to project, but this is so, like, older sibling of divorced parent shit. To, like, be super independent. No one really knows what you're doing. Have a plan and, like, everything figured out. Be super afraid of doing the wrong thing and people being disappointed in you. Like, this is what older siblings of separated parents do.
I love that you come into every like serious conversation with like a business plan. Like, before you get upset, I already have people investing on the back end. So sharks, what I'm asking for today is like 100% of not hitting me.
100% of not hitting. But I also like that her parents, and this is where like I think our moms and parents who were like too afraid to let us watch this movie would have benefited from watching to see how parents should react, because they never yell, ever. There is some disappointment that's to be expected, but they make it very clear, like, your body, your plan, and they support her in that plan, which is like, honestly, mind-boggling, because I've had many friends and family members who were pregnant young, and that was not the case for how the family dynamic went at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really cool to see that they even suggest at a certain point, like, abortion is an option for you. Like, they're not like pussyfooting around the options here.
Yeah. I think what hopefully this scene like taught some people is like, no teenager wants to get pregnant in the middle of high school. I mean, some kids just don't have access to condoms or healthcare or information or education that they should have.
God, I really feel it's like education, like not knowing, which in Juno's case, I'm like, she's so smart and she knows so much. What the heck? But
But typically
accidents
like
happen.
The girls that I knew in high school getting pregnant were just, I just don't think that they were like given truthful and honest and earnest information about how to have sex without having a child, because everything that we were taught was abstinence.
Yeah. And I think all the men too, like, it's more important that they follow some sort of rules and withhold themselves and know how their bodies react in order to have safe sex. Like, probably even more importantly than I would say the woman, even though the risks are higher for her, the stakes are higher. Like, since when do we teach men how to use condoms, you know?
No, absolutely. I didn't even mention that because societally that is never going to be the standard. Like,
yeah, it's all about the woman being careful, careful. But what about on the other side?
It's just gross negligence. Like, teenagers should be taught how a fucking baby is made. Like, it's just so gross that we've never considered that being like a universal standard. But anyways, her parents take it as well as they possibly can, and they go to her dad and Juno go to Mark and Vanessa's house. Mark is played by Jason Bateman. Vanessa is played by Jennifer Garner. Incredible casting.
Oh my God.
This would win that like Oscars cast award.
Oh, the best ensemble casting award?
Yes.
That they're introducing? Definitely.
They hit all the notes here. I mean, they live in a perfect neighborhood in this like perfect house. And Juno and her father enter to meet their lawyer, Goethe Raus. And Juno is like certain she wants a closed adoption, meaning she's not going to have any updates on the child or like any contact with the child whatsoever. And while we see that Vanessa is very like eager to be a mom, Mark is like completely withdrawn. He keeps saying things like, oh, she's always wanted to be a mother. She's always wanted, you know, stuff that's not very like we statements, but like she wants this. And then after this, shortly, we get the ultrasound tech scene where, like, ultrasound tech makes, like, a really snide comment about being happy that Juno's not going to parent this child.
Toxic environment. How do you know I'm so toxic anyway?
These people I could give this baby to could be, like, total molesters, stage parents.
Negligent.
And a fucking Allison Janney goes in on this fucking tech. She goes, oh, you think you're so special because you get to play picture pages up there? My 5-year-old daughter can do that. And let me tell you, she's not the brightest bulb in the tanning bed. So why don't you go back to night school in Mantino and learn a real trade?
I love how they're always talking shit about Mantino also. Like, fuck Mantino.
They're in, like, River City, Minnesota or something.
And Liberty Bell. Her fucking stepsister is named Liberty Bell.
Maybe LB did it.
Oh, my God. It's too rich. It's too good. I love a tell-off. Allison Janney, supreme mother.
Okay, no one could ever do it like her. She's killing it. So I guess I don't know if you've noticed, but I haven't been putting a lot of emphasis on Juno and Polly's relationship.
Well, yeah, the film doesn't do so either.
Yeah, the film doesn't. And I know for the like effort of this podcast, we're really talking about the queer stuff. So it's not really a service to the theme we're trying to point out. But you know, a part of this movie that I think is really important that I didn't really notice until I started watching it as an adult is this, like, really inappropriate relationship between Mark and Juno. And I remember being a teenager watching this in the theater or watching it on DVD, like, in high school and thinking, well, they're going to be friends. It's fine. They have stuff in common. They're friends. And then watching it recently as, like, a 28-year-old being like, you have nothing fucking in common with that 16-year-old.
Yeah.
What the fuck are you doing with her?
Yeah.
And this is, like, one of the scenes that makes me really uncomfortable where, like, Juno goes to Mark and Vanessa's house and Vanessa's not there. And Mark shows Juno this cover of a Carpenters song, which is actually really fucking good. Sonic Youth, it's a great cover. And this is where Juno says her favorite band is a 3-way tie between the Stooges, Patti Smith, and the Runaways, which classic is like actually a lesbian cocktail of favorite bands. Thank you, Juno. And he says he's going to make her some CDs.
You are offended. Your eye just twitched.
That's a gross thing to do for a child.
Yeah, he really encourages Juno to come over whenever she wants, hang out. In fact, it's like, oh, Vanessa's not here. We're safe. We're good to hang out.
You caught that when he said that?
Oh, it's so bad. And I think it's even more fucked up because, like I mentioned earlier, like, though Juno is a really, like, self-assured and unique character, like, there is a loneliness to her character that I didn't pick up till this last time, because, like, though she has a lot of people supporting her, I think what she really wants is the support of Bleeker, like, someone who's her equal in this scenario. And the closest she has to that is Jason Bateman, especially because he makes himself so available. So I think it's, like, really fucked up that he, I don't know, like, he's lonely, she's lonely, and he, like, uses that to, like, fulfill his own inner fucking self-worth. It's just really gross. And I'm glad they don't go any further into their relationship before Juno's like, no, I'm not crossing that line. That's never what I intended. But it just sucks that, like, in her vulnerable state, that that's where it ends up.
You make a really good point. I think you illustrated that very well. Like what Juno is experiencing way too young, feeling the insecurity of like having a child and wanting to know that like my partner in this situation can handle caring for this child as well. And she doesn't have that. She's not in a place to like plan a life with like Polly Bleeker,
yeah.
You know? So she knows she's giving this baby to this couple and Vanessa's very much like, she has kind of high walls built,
mm-hmm.
but Mark is very accessible. And she's like, if there's someone who can assure me that like this baby's going to go to like a complex, cool person that's going to love it, it's going to be Mark because he's like always around. I think very much what she's searching for is like an intimacy and like some sort of affirmation that it's going to be okay,
yeah,
in a way that she could really understand. And what he's interpreting from this is like, this young person is interested in me.
This young person thinks I'm cool.
And it's so fucking icky, dude.
I know. Well, it definitely like is written like that. Like that's how we're supposed to feel about him.
No, I totally understand that now. But like I said, when I watched it when I was 16,
yeah.
I did not pick up on that.
Not the context of age. Yeah, because he's like clearly in his mid-30s or something.
Like who in their even mid-20s has anything to do with a 16-year-old? There's like no, shouldn't be any overlap.
And like not to get even more like sad and almost bleak about this, but one of the things I think Juno is really battling with at like the core of her anxiety about this child is that like she doesn't really have an example of like a relationship of two people staying together.
Mm-hmm.
And she expresses that concern to her dad in the kitchen scene later in the film before she gives birth. But in a way, like by her taking care of this baby, she has like the control of someone having the perfect life that she never had for once, because like she was 5 when her parents split up. She didn't have any control over that. And so she gets to make the decision for this baby and gets to be like, okay, if this little baby, my baby, is off and living like the perfect cookie cutter life that I envisioned for them with the cool parents and lots of money in the big house, like that's one way she can, I guess, just like feel okay about what her situation is. And so that's why it sucks all the more whenever she realizes Vanessa and what's-his-name's relationship is falling apart.
Yeah.
It's like, I think, picking at the thread that, like, she felt being abandoned by her mom early on.
Yeah, because she mentions, like, my mom sometimes sends me a cactus on Valentine's Day, and it's like, wow, this cactus gram hurts more than your abandonment.
Yeah, you're right.
So it's, yeah, as you're saying, like, she has a very limited set of control, but, like, at this point is the most meaningful amount of control that she can have in this, like, young person's life,
mm-hmm.
to just set them up. If I can just give them the best baseline starting point,
yeah.
then at least I've done everything I can do. And I think that a lot of this relationship she's seeking with Mark is like to affirm that she's doing the best that she can, and it's signaling some gross shit to him.
Mm-hmm.
But as they're like hanging out in this weird, inappropriate way, he says that they plan on naming the baby Madison if it's a girl. And she looks at him and goes, isn't that a little gay? And as this like moment's going on, it like seems really intimate and odd, and Vanessa gets home and the vibe shifts immediately.
Yeah.
Like it's the like, oh, mom's home.
Yeah.
Can't do anything fun. They like separate super quickly, like instantaneously. And like the moment seems really tense between Mark and Vanessa. Like as soon as Juno's out of frame, they're kind of, Vanessa's looking at Mark like, what the fuck are you doing with that fucking teenager?
Yeah, right.
Understandably. And later at the mall, Juno's at the mall with Leah, and they see from like the top floor Vanessa with like a kid, and Vanessa and this kid are like playing around in this like playpen. And I know that Juno's not supposed to be gay in this movie, even though a lot of her characteristics signal to be so. I know it's not canon, but she looks like she's falling in love with Vanessa in this scene.
Like the slow pushing, the adoring gaze.
And she's like, wow. And then the next scene is followed by like Vanessa speaking to Juno's stomach.
Mm-hmm.
And that almost seems as intimately romantic as the scene before. So I'm going to show you that very quickly.
Okay.
Also, they run into Vanessa before the scene that I show you. And Vanessa says she's just at the mall shopping with her girlfriends. And Leah goes, you're gay. The way that's over, you're gay.
That's like such a thing in the 2000s, though, for your mom to call her friends her girlfriends.
I hate that.
You should try talking to it. Because like supposedly they can hear you, even though it's all like 10,000 leagues under the sea.
Hi, baby. It's me. It's Vanessa. can't wait to meet you.
Lizzie, please describe that scene if you could.
So Juno and Leah are at the mall and they run into Vanessa out of the blue. And so Vanessa asks to touch Juno's belly whenever Juno feels the baby kick. And they have this really intimate moment where Juno encourages her to talk to the belly, even though it's 10,000 leagues under the sea. And yeah, it's this really intimate moment that I think it fills that hole, that loneliness that Juno has that I was talking about earlier. And yeah, if the situation was different, I would love to have seen this be their movie. Like if Juno wasn't a teenager, but like maybe in her mid-20s at Sarah Lawrence or whatever. But yeah, because they have so much chemistry.
Yeah, I don't mean to like posturize that there is like a sequel that should come out where Vanessa and Juno are going to live the rest of their lives together. I'm just saying
Leave that to the fan fiction.
Come on. There's AO3 for a reason. But I'm just saying, as a person who is like so obsessed with the subtext, like if we remove the context from that scene, mm-hmm. that like Vanessa's adopting this child or what have you, what it really is like apparent just alone in that moment with like very few words is that there is like this intimacy flowing with all three people. Like Juno to Vanessa, Vanessa to this baby, and this baby in both directions. Mm-hmm. And they're all looking at each other with so much love mm-hmm. and support and excitement for this like new life that they're going to be like entering into the world. And so lovely. I know when I was in high school, I watched this movie like a disgusting amount of times, and I was so fucking gay and had a huge crush on both Jennifer Garner and Elliot Page. So like really any angle this movie hit me in upside the head, I had complete whiplash, J.K. Simmons. but I was slicing dice in this film every which way backwards, and I know this scene really meant a lot to me. So if I'm reaching, then take me away, coppers, in the paddy wagon, because that's what I've got to do here.
I plead guilty. No, it's probably the most intimate moment in the film, mm-hmm. for sure. Juno even says, like, oh, yeah, everyone at school touches my belly all the time. But I guarantee the moment isn't like this, you know?
So later on, Juno finds out that Bleeker is taking Soupy Sales to prom. It's like Lipton Landing.
Katrina. Yeah.
So she gets dolled up and she goes to hang out with Mark. And it's that moment where she walks in and she goes, is Vanessa here? And Mark goes, no, we're safe. Gross.
A red flag.
And in the basement, Mark and Juno are dancing to Mata Hoople's All the Young Dudes, and we get this scene.
I'm leaving Vanessa.
What?
Getting a place in the city, got it all planned. This is something I've been wanting to do for a long time.
No.
No?
No, you definitely can't do that. That's one big fat sack of... No.
What is the matter?
What the... I mean... You guys are supposed to take care of this, you know?
Thought you'd be cool with this.
Cool. I want things to be perfect. I don't want them to be shitty and broken like everyone else's family.
How do you think of me? You know, why are you over here?
I just like being a piece of furniture in your weird life.
The reason that I show you that scene and the reason that I feel so like grossed out by Mark and Juno's relationship is I think very well illustrated by the scene I showed you before with Juno and Vanessa. I think that in that scene where that intimacy is flowing, where she's watching Vanessa becoming a mother and like doing the motherly things, and then she's expecting Mark to do the same, I think she wants to put herself in their relationship. Like, I feel like sometimes she wants to be Mark with Vanessa, and sometimes she wants to be Vanessa with Mark. I think sometimes it's important for her to see this is what Vanessa looks like as a partner who's about to have a baby. This is what Mark looks like as a partner who's about to have a baby.
Yeah.
And feeling the affirmation there. And Vanessa's very much giving that. And Mark, at this point, totally turns on a head. And it's like, well, all of the attention you're giving me signals that, like, young people are into me and I need to divorce my wife.
Oh my God, you're so right. It's so fucking sad.
It's
gross.
Bad, dude.
And she gives him a piece of her mind.
As she should. Oh my God. Yeah. And the scene is just followed immediately with like Juno running upstairs crying. Vanessa gets home. And before Vanessa knows what's going on, she looks at Mark and says,
what did you do?
Mm-hmm.
She knows. Mm-hmm. She knows this man.
Mm-hmm.
She was like, grow the fuck up. You can't have all your little Lego toys and your stupid Sonic Youth posters in my pretty ass house.
After this, Vanessa and Mark fall apart. Juno and her dad have a really beautiful speech a la Call Me By Your Name, where it's like, love totally. Can exist. You know, it's very much in that exact moment.
Wait, it also feels like really gay advice because she's talking about like, can't two people ever be together anymore? Like, how do you even know like love is real? And he says, find a person who loves you for exactly who you are. You know, bad mood, good mood, ugly, pretty, whatever. And to me, that just felt like very universal love.
Somebody that thinks the sun shines out your ass.
Shines out your ass. I want you to know, I haven't said it yet, but maybe, I don't know, like the full moon is tonight. Maybe I'm like on my period soon. Who the fuck knows? But I was crying.
I will tell you.
So many times in this movie.
At this point, it was like the floodgates fucking opened. Stream of tears, crying.
Crying.
So Juno fills Bleeker's mailbox with orange Tic Tacs. She meets him on the track and says, you're the coolest person I've ever met and you don't even have to try.
He's like, I try really hard.
The most Tumblr post of 2007. Thank you. One photo being, I love you and you don't even have to try. Next photo, I try really hard, actually.
I try really hard, actually.
And then soon after this, Juno's water breaks and Juno gives birth. And we see Juno and Bleeker embrace in the hospital bed, crying happy tears.
Crying, crying, crying to what song, Sam?
And we hear Juno say, Bleeker decided he didn't want to see the baby. Neither did I. He didn't feel like ours. I think he was always hers.
Crying.
I'm sorry. I'm not even on my period. That can kill me. And we hear the narration, like, it all ended with a chair. And you see the rocking chair. Mm. And it, like, zooms out onto Vanessa's yellow nursery. And above the crib where Vanessa imagined her first family photo would be is a Jiffy Lube receipt that says, Vanessa, if you're still in, I'm still in. Do you know?
How props are making me cry. Like, I don't even want kids and I'm crying.
I know. I don't want them and I'm fucking fucking sobbing. So we end the film in a beautiful place where we see Juno and Bleeker happy together and they're performing this absolute banger.
Here is a church and here is a steeple. We sure are cute for two ugly people. Don't see what anyone can see in anyone else. But
so I have a fun fact about that song.
Tell me, please.
I entered into a talent show and played that song with one of my really good friends in college.
No way.
We did not win, but we did play the whole song.
Hey, and that counts. I know that you and your partner still do that at karaoke. It's a karaoke stable for you, too.
Yeah, it's such a cute song, and it's easy to sing. It's in my range.
Well, that's the film, folks. I'm not crying. You're fucking crying.
Don't you dare make me cry.
On to the reception. With a budget of $6.5 million, this film went on to earn $232.3 million.
Jesus.
At the box
office. Oh my God. Everyone went and saw this movie.
Everyone in the world went and saw this movie, yourself included. It's a financial and critical success. The film went on to receive 4 Oscar nominations.
Wow.
Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actress, and it actually won Best Original Screenplay for Diablo Cody.
What?
This was Diablo Cody's first Oscar, like I mentioned. It's the first nominations for Jason Reitman and Elliot Page. And this made Page the 4th youngest nominee in the Best Actor category and the first known trans actor to be nominated for any acting Oscar ever. While this was a success, the film would also become a point of political fodder for the oncoming debate about abortion rights and the rising rate of teen pregnancy. This also fell into the presidential campaign of 2008.
Jesus.
And I don't know if you guys remember, like, A Secret Life of an American Teenager, Teen Mom.
Yeah. All came out. Teen Mom came like a couple years after this, right?
Mm-hmm. So this was 2007. Secret Life of the American Teenager was 2008. Teen Mom was 2009.
God, Teen Mom just had like a whole thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, I remember this very like vividly, that this was like a huge moment, that my parents thought that me and all of my sisters were just going to get randomly pregnant because this was such a huge part.
This will empower us to get pregnant.
Yeah. No, I mean, because this was Obama versus McCain, mm-hmm. 2008. And this was like a huge part of the debates that they had to go on. And then Sarah Palin was named like John McCain's running partner, and her daughter got pregnant at the age of 17. Mm-hmm. And chose to, like, keep her child. So this movie fell into this, like, weird lexicon where it was used by both pro-choice and pro-life. People across the aisle quoting it for so many different fucking reasons.
Interesting.
Yeah, in 2007, Diablo Cody said, "In a way, I feel like I had a responsibility to make it more explicitly pro-choice." Something that disturbed me over the years is people perceiving Juno as an anti-choice movie. And then the next year in 2018, she said that the only thing that I would have changed in the film is to make it clear as to why Juno chose not to have an abortion. She said it was simply because she didn't want to. It was not about any type of feeling that abortion was wrong. I'm pro-choice. She also wants to say that some people have interpreted the movie as anti-choice, which is deeply unsettling.
Which is also like, how? Because she's never at one point pressured to get an abortion or not. She chooses for her own reasons. And pro-choice means to choose not to do it if you so wish. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I think people forget that. Just because you're pro-choice doesn't mean every single time you have a pregnancy scare, you're going to grab an abortion pill.
And it also doesn't mean every time a story is centered around someone being pregnant has anything to do with abortion or, yeah. You know, like she considered having one, but the reason that she didn't have one wasn't this like revelatory moment in the film that like she's not talking to Jesus. She's not talking to like the gospel. She's just like, hey, maybe I don't want one. And she just moves on very quickly.
Yeah. And she's like, next plan.
Yeah. So I understand where Diablo Cody is coming from. Like, I remember this film being used like as like first cited references in a lot of these like disgusting Republicans like fucking debates. So I remember that being really, really odd. Another thing about the reception, the soundtrack was one of the most successful in the time that it was released. It was the first number one soundtrack since Dreamgirls, which was a fucking musical, so that's insane. And it's 20th Century Fox's first number one soundtrack since Titanic.
Damn. Everyone was obsessed with this movie.
We all love Kimya Dawson. We all love Belle and Sebastian. We all love the Kinks. We all
Cat
love
Power.
Sonic Youth. Yeah. Cat Power. And yeah, so basically that's what I have to say about the reception.
So now what I think we got to do is score this movie, eh?
Okay, Lizzie, explain how the subtextual score works.
How we rate our films around here at Subtextual is we each get to rate the film on a scale of 1 to 10 for how gay the movie is and how good the movie is. And we average those together and get a single subtextual score.
All right, Lizzie, how good is the movie?
9, easily.
I would second that. I would give it an 8.
Okay.
And Lizzie, how gay is the movie?
Like the fabric it's made out of is gay.
In the denim.
It's in the denim. Juno and Leah were dating the whole time. A 5. I give it a 5.
Yeah, I'm going to give it a 6. Like Lizzie mentioned, all the BTS just confirmed everything I already knew.
Exactly. And the fact that it's somehow about a young woman having sex with a man and having a baby and still feeling really gay despite all of that is pretty impressive.
That gives us an overall subtextual score of 7.
Hell yeah.
Even. That feels very right.
Yeah.
I guess I'll just go and call you on my hamburger phone now.
I've always wanted a hamburger phone. Can you get me a hamburger phone for Christmas?
Absolutely. Will you get me some boysenberry condoms? It makes my boyfriend's junk smell like pie.
You got it. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to keep this content ad-free, please consider supporting us on patreon.com/subtextualpod. See you next week.